Hey everybody, this is Alex, and it is just the two of us. Mike Seymour is in Sydney. Hey Mike.
Hey, how are you, Alex?
And how is it in Sydney there?
Look, it's astonishingly good. It's sunny, but it's just pleasant, basically. Yeah, Sydney
Excellent.
Always
I'm,
is very LA.
I'm hoping the Sydney weather moves this way. And I was in Vancouver, it was raining like crazy, and now I'm in San Francisco, and it's raining like crazy, and so hopefully it'll dry up for us. Speaking of San Francisco, we're talking this episode about the Zodiac, which of course is a recreation of a true event in the late 60s. We had a serial killer that was never found, and David Fincher put together a little movie about the Zodiac, and there's a lot of interesting things. I think actually, as I start, you know, when Mike suggested that we do the Zodiac, I was kind of like, I don't know how many effects there really were, and it was just like one of those things that didn't mean that much to me. And then when you get into it and you see how much was done, it's actually a fascinating process. Now, the first thing is that the whole movie was shot digitally. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Mike?
It was, it's been Fincher's desire, apparently, to shoot digital for a while, and they actually looked at it around Panic Room stage. And as you know, from around Panic Room, Fincher has a reputation for previs, and he's very... I don't know if you knew this, Alex, but apparently David Fincher was actually a camera assistant in the Matt department at ILM. So he actually has a very tech-savvy sort of CV, I guess.
And he actually worked with Craig Barron, I believe, from Matt World.
Yeah, apparently, and Digital Domain did the effects. But just to get back to your original point about the workflow, yeah, you're absolutely right. It is interesting, just in the workflow alone, because they were using six Viper cameras. Now, Vipers are a camera that are effectively sitting somewhere around the HD mark, though often not considered just a straight HD camera. They're a tapeless 444 1920 by 1080. But they tend to produce a signal that has quite a latitude for grading, so not to be confused with an HD cam or something like that. And that would be my first point. Sitting in the cinema now, admittedly, I was at a press screening, but it was a new print and everything. But this was a very good looking film. I mean, up on the screen, just staring at it. I don't know if you looked at Collateral or Miami Vice or anything, which were shot not on Vipers, but that for me had sort of a video-y feel in parts. There was almost like a smearing that it's hard to define that just said to me straight away, this is digital cinematography. And for the love of God, I couldn't see it in this one. I mean, I was looking for it. I was really sitting there, you know, this is one of the things I want to see. I want to really study it. I'd look at focus. I'd look at everything I could think of. And it just looked like a clean, sharp, gorgeous film. And
from what I understand, a lot of Fincher's interest in this was to give him a lot more latitude of just being able to shoot a lot, not have to deal with the film, not have to deal with breakdowns. I mean, those were a lot of the reasons that it appeared that he was bringing up of why he wanted to do it. And David Fincher is known for being a bit of a control freak. I think he would accept that title, and so it does seem like this gives him a lot of control on set, and so the entire pipeline, it was completely digital. Is that correct?
Yeah, literally the camera negative of this film is 18,220,156 DPX files. That's it, right? The stuff came offset on a what they call a DMAG, which is a type of disc, effectively. Would come back to the post-production setup, and they would make LTO-3 copies. So in other words, I guess you could argue that was the only tape involved, but that was simply just an archive backup format of the data. And you need those sorts of things for insurance. And then,
I was just going to say that when you said that, is that what the fascinating thing about this whole thing, I mean, you want to do it, but what I really found out was how much you have to, when you're getting insurance for your film, you actually have to show them how you're going to back up the digital data and really establish a pipeline for that, or they won't give you they won't insure the film.
I don't know if you read this, but in one of the podcasts that Jeff Huser did with the post-production team, he made the remark that Fincher has said to him when the studio said, well, we're a bit worried about how this digital data is going to move around the place because this is awfully valuable, these discs. And he said, it'll be the same underpaid PA that's driving at 3 o'clock in the morning that normally drives your neg to the lab.
Yeah, exactly. And it is you know, and I have to admit that because we work in a digital pipeline, you know, it is a you know, the idea of going back, we do a little bit to tape right now, just to tape, and we get film every once in a while, and it appears kind of gooey when you're used to, you know, dealing with these direct to drive you know, processes. I guess we haven't lost any data yet. I'm sure we'll differently when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, and you could easily lose NEG as well. I mean, I know of cases that people have, you know, not very often, of course, but people have opened exposed camera NEG tins, and of course, the second you open that, you've just ruined the whole reel. But look, what's I think an interesting point made by Andreas Wacker, who's one of the men who engineered or post-production experts who engineered the pipeline, is that because it was tapeless, because it was all going into then basically servers and then split off for Final Cut, and they had a 40 terabyte XSAN, because they were working this way, it was a scalable workflow. And by that he means that even if you shoot digitally on tape, like say on a SR tape, the SR tape's going to run at a certain speed no matter what. It's predictable, it's reliable, but you can't scale it. You can't do faster than real time. It is what it is, right?
Right.
Whereas when they needed more power, they could just add more computers and everything would run faster. You know?
Right.
And that's where this will really take off, in his opinion. I have to agree with him that the tapeless workflow is scalable. And if you do need to transfer vast amounts of stuff and you have the budget to do it, then, you know, you just add more computers to the problem and the problem gets smaller, which doesn't, you know, happen in any kind of linear tape or any kind of workflow, be it film or tape. It's still linear. It's still, you know, you have to scroll through X to get to Y, which just doesn't happen when everything's running on off disks. And I think that really was just, I'm pretty sure, I can't think of any other tapeless digital production. Obviously, we've seen Star Wars and Superman and stuff as tape digital, but this was the first major Hollywood tapeless production I'd seen. And as I said, the thing that got me more than anything else, notwithstanding the great visual effects and everything else, is just how good the film looked, just how clean and nice the pictures were.
And I really think that this is, like a lot of other things, this is another crack, you know, in that glass ceiling over top of, you know, shooting digitally. I mean, when you start seeing films like this coming out, you know, it becomes harder and harder to argue that you should be using, you know, film at all, you know, at least in the acquisition. And distribution, it really, you know, doesn't make a lot of sense. So the now this was edited in. Did you say edited in Final Cut? Is that correct?
Was really interesting. They brought all that data in, as we mentioned a moment ago, and then they actually down converted. I mean, they kept, of course, the original 444, but they down converted to DVC Pro HD, and it's DVC Pro HD that they then used for the offline editing. And what's interesting, of course, is that it was very easy for them with the Final Cut system running off discs to online at any time, because it was all, again, just, you know, you didn't have to do a tape online, which takes quite a long time, and load up tons of stuff and walk through all the different archives. It was all off data, and it would just access with a tape robot, and you could produce it online. And they did, in fact, produce a bunch of tapeless onlines for Res. And when they wanted to do a temp DI screening, which they got Price Petherell in, who actually used to be at Digital Domain, worked on Apollo 13, and he set up a DI kind of service thing. And so he came over, and they just simply connected up to the SAN, and he pulled off the latest version of the cut and applied a temporary DI, and, you know, they could just watch it straight away. And that's got to be great for a director to see their film at high quality whenever they like, without having this sort of more fixed offline online process. But when they did come to do the final online, again, they used Final Cut Pro, so it was all an FCP project.
Well, and what's interesting is that, you know, that we do a lot of, obviously, some HD stuff, and the only time, you know, we shoot 444, and the only time we see the full res data is when we're capturing and when we're rendering the final out. Everything in between, and because we spent, you know, we have five editors in three continents that work on a lot of the stuff that we're doing, ours is only 384 by 216. so these wee little files that are, you know, these photo JPEG files, and they edit all of that stuff down, you know, for the shows that we're working on. You know, you couldn't do that for this kind of thing. But it is, you know, it's amazing. And then all you do is, you know, reconnect. They send back the Final Cut Pro files. So they get this little file on about, you know, a couple hundred megs on an FTP server. They edit the whole thing. They send it all. All they have to do is email us back the Final Cut Pro file. We relink it to the high-res files and, you know, hit render. You know, and that's a, you know, that process is something that has become, you know, very addicting to us. And by the way, for the listeners who, the reason that DVC Pro is used is that is that that DVC Pro is Final Cut. You know, Panasonic and Apple work very closely, and DVC Pro is very optimized in Final Cut Pro. So if you're using on a desktop, the 1080 version of DVC Pro, and on the laptop, 720p can be played back in real time. So you can be doing at least straight cuts without any kind of delays. And man, I gotta say, when I was working on Star Wars Episode One, we were doing AVR 6 and an Avid. And it looks nothing like that.
And in fact, that's what Fincher did. He was editing, and he'd have up often three cameras per any scene that they'd set up, and then he'd have them up on the screens, and he could judge really well the performances and then pick what to cut from and to. And I think the editor's name was Angus Wall, but he also used Final Cut to do some keying and did some motion stuff. And so they were like, you know, pre-vising and working shots up. Because to get back to your earlier point, there is actually quite a few visual effects shots in this film, even though remarkably it looks almost as if there are none.
And I think this is a great example of, you know, these films that we always hear about that, you know, we can talk about Pirates of the Caribbean, we can talk about a lot of these big visual effects films, but this is one that has a couple hundred, isn't it, about 200 effect shots in it?
And some really remarkable stuff at that, like that, that literally I felt guilty that I didn't know there were visual effect shots until I was reading up about it afterwards. You know, because you kind of pride yourself on, well, I can get that kind of thing. And there'd be scenes, I think the most obvious to me, in the good side of things, I don't want to be like, too plus and minusy, but there's a scene with a taxi, there's a murder in the taxi for those that haven't seen it, and it's at night, it's on a corner of a street, and now I'm watching this and I'm thinking, yeah, maybe there's something in a couple of these shots, and there was one that I thought of sort of, you know, not a particularly, I'm not really comfortable with that matte painting, but the rest of the time I just assumed that didn't blend in with the rest of the shots. What I didn't realize is the rest of the shots were digital.
Yeah, definitely. And they rebuilt an entire environment for one of the shots. For a six-minute scene, right?
And what I think is so funny, and you're going to love this because of the work with PixelCorp, is that the tools that they used, I mean, obviously they used a lot of tools, but some of the tools they used to pull off this sequence started with Google Earth, which I thought was hysterical, because they just tried to work out where they could place the cameras on the real street in San Francisco based off Google Earth. And then from there they did AutoCAD. They also used Image Modeler and 3D Max. And it was really like, I mean, those aren't tools out of the reach of any visual effects artist. I mean, they're not necessarily, you know, as cheap as chips, but they're certainly not, like, we're not talking about things that anyone couldn't get their hands on. And so it was kind of really interesting to see not only was this policy of being flexible happening at the core of the production with the whole workflow we've described, but the vendors, Digital Domain and Mattwell Digital in particular, seemed to be really concentrating on the aesthetics and the quality of those and using what we might consider to be off-the-shelf tools.
Well, and I think that that's actually fairly common from my experience for a lot of matte companies, you know, folks that focus on mattes. I mean, they, you know, everything about that is making it look real and working through it, and they spend a lot of time in Photoshop. And they really, matte painters that I've worked with, at least, tend to be very wily. You know, they are the masters of cheats. You know, and they, you know, they don't need a big render farm, and they don't need a big, you know, typically, you know, they have these, you know, they have off-the-shelf programs. What makes the difference in their case almost always is an incredible, you know, artistic background and the ability to really produce. I mean, these guys, most of these guys, you know, they can just draw it out. And I think that's what we saw here, is taking some very simple tools and doing some, you know, really amazing things with them. And I really thought, you know, these kind of shows are, when you're trying to do a time, you know, jumping back in time 30 or 40 years, it can be very challenging to get all those pieces correct.
Look, I think that the work that Mattwell Digital's done is excellent. I mean, I've thought that for ages. They just do outstanding stuff, back from when they were doing stuff in Casino and doing set extensions. But and I think you're absolutely right in everything you said, except for we also shouldn't paint the picture that they were just faking it, because when they needed to, for example, the cars driving across the overpass in the push-in shot of San Francisco, which is pretty much just a full-on big CG shot, they even got the reflections on the windshields right on these tiny little cars that are just driving down on the foreshore kind of thing. And, I mean, there I was watching a pristine print off a good projection in a perfect throw, and I knew to look for that, and I couldn't see what was going on, right? So they obviously had a huge attention to detail as well, and I think Mattwell Digital has been really good at bridging that, the world that you described, the world of just faking it and being very good, but also not being afraid to use hardcore 3D when they need to.
Yeah, and that is, you know, the attention to detail is typically what makes great matte companies and matte painters what they are, is this, they pay attention to the craziest little details that make it all work. Now, one of the things that I thought was interesting in the waterfront shot, so there's a waterfront shot, which is interesting to me as someone who lives in San Francisco, because you see this waterfront shot, and it's, you know, there's a highway there that doesn't exist anymore after the, you know, before the earthquake.
Oh, right,
and
of course, yeah.
And so it was funny to see this shot, and there's you know, there's no highway there anymore. It's just a big walkway. And but one of the things that I thought was interesting is they actually combined. It was actually two different companies working on the same shot. So Matt World, I believe, worked on the, you know, obviously all the buildings in the background, and it said the Tweak Films, I guess, actually did the water. And you know, Tweak Films is a smaller, it's a boutique that's here in San Francisco. They're, and I don't know all the guys. I know Seth Rosenthal used to be over at ILM, and a bunch of the other guys are, you know, they, what they really focus on is just hard segments of films. And, you know, and so they, but one of the things that they're really good at is water. But what I thought was amazing when you look at this process of having all these different visual effects firms working on something, that now we're not even talking about sending, you know, it used to be we'd send out a scene to a Digital Domain and a scene to ILM, and then we'd send out, then it got to a point where we're sending out this shot and that shot to one company or another, and now we're sending, you know, the top half of this shot out to this company and the bottom half to that company, and it's, I just found that to be kind of an interesting, you know, development in the process.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but the same thing happened on that one we were talking about earlier with the taxi driver, because I know that the taxi in that was a Digital Domain model, and that
right.
They handed that over to Matwell Digital for the rest. And I got to say, that's one thing I really admire about, I don't know, maybe it's just unique to California, but there seems to be such a attitude of cooperation for the benefit of the film. Like, you don't get people at facilities in LA and San Francisco bitching about each other. You get them saying, yeah, I think those guys did a really good job, and I'm looking forward to working with them. And I don't know whether you found that to be unique to America, to San Francisco, sorry, to California, but they do. There does seem to be a good attitude over there of just cooperating for the benefit of whatever that takes to make it work, if you know what I mean.
I think part of it is that it's a very incestuous group. You know, so we, you know, a vast number of the companies are either, you know, were started by ex-ILMers, were, are, you know, have people there, and then also they trade them around. There's a ton of Digital Domain people that now, that, you know, then went to ILM, then went to somewhere else. And so I think part of it is that in California specifically, you have an enormous amount of cross-pollination of people, you know, between all these companies, so that there's this, you know, there, it's hard because it's not working with some company you've never worked with. I think also that there, you know, there is a fair amount of work. This is kind of a growth area, and everyone knows there's a lot of people, a lot of companies are really getting specialized. They don't want to do everything. You know, they want to do what they do well, and they want someone else to do the other part. You know, and I think that that's, you know, it used to be that one company wanted to take over all the, you know, all 2,000 effect shots, and that's just not, it's not even that they can't do it anymore, it's that most of them don't want to. It's not cost effective to be able to do everything, you know, at film level.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good thing, of course. I mean, when the London facilities bandied together 10 years ago and mm-hmm. started SoHoNet and that kind of stuff, we saw a huge growth in the films that were acceptable to go to London, because all of a sudden we had a position whereby a producer or whatever could see that they could get a bunch of companies to work on the shots. They could see that those shots would get serviced by people that had backup in case anything went wrong. And I think I guess it's a universal thing, but the more collaboration tends to just breed more work, and that's a good thing, I guess.
Well, obviously, that's something that I'm really into. So, but you know, beyond the matte paintings, now what did Digital Domain really dig into in this film?
There are a couple of murder sequences as well as stuff to do with the cities. I mean, I should say that if you haven't seen the film, some of the murders are quite gruesome, and there's a stabbing sequence I mean, I'm not into slash and horror, so I guess this isn't the sort of film where it's like, you know, look behind you, for God's sake, look behind you, you know. It's right. A pretty, you know, sensible drama, and most of the drama is taking place in what happens to the lives of the people that are trying to hunt down the serial killer. But when they do have some murders, they kind of, on at least a couple of them, don't pull any punches. And on one in particular, the stabbing sequence in broad daylight of a couple is pretty hardcore. And I found myself looking away a bit for that. And I guess at some level, you got to expect that if you go and see a film about a serial killer. But yeah, so Digital
Domain... And what they did there, I guess, from my understanding, was is that they that the reason that they, these became effects films, these shots normally wouldn't be an effects shot, except that David Fincher predictably really wanted to do a lot of takes, and this involved blood. Is that correct? I mean, this was so what he didn't want to do was clean it all up, right?
Well, that's a good point, actually. The reset time on set, I don't know if you've ever been there shooting with squibs and stuff, but, you know, you do the first take and it's never right, but the reset time to redress all those things, in this case it was stabbing, of course, but same thing applies with squibs and blood and stuff, that, you know, it's not just the actor, it's the actor's clothes, it's wardrobe, it's makeup, it's all the ground around them. It's like, you know, it really is a long process to stab somebody to death multiple times on any given day on a shoot. So, yeah, and you know, you were seeing kind of piercing things that obviously weren't going to be easily done with practical elements,
right? And the interesting thing is that a lot of people now, especially someone that's as technical as Fincher, is that you'll start doing the math and decide, you know, if I can do it photorealistically with in a computer. You know, those reset times, let's say there's 60 or 80 or 100 people on set, which is not unusual for a film to be running. If it takes, you know, a half an hour to reset the set, which is totally reasonable, that's 40 hours of time that you've just spent at whatever rate. It doesn't take very long. If you want to do three or four, you now have a budget of, you know, you're starting to get close to a budget of $15, $20, $30, $40,000 just to do it in CG, you know, and still have more control over it, which, once again, Fincher is known for.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that Digital Domain did as well. There was a shot by a highway kind of thing where somebody actually survived and runs up to stop a truck, and apparently Fincher just wasn't really happy with how it was looking on the day. And that's a classic problem of, well, what do? We, you know, reschedule? Do we come back? Do we find a new location? What's the deal? And in the end, it was just like, you know what? I know what I want. Let's put up a blue screen. Even though I'm here, we'll just shoot at blue screen. We'll get the right lighting and we'll just make the rest of it digitally in the background. And those sorts of things that Digital Domain did are exactly the sort of thing that, as I say, I couldn't pick. And I've got to say that I think Digital Domain has been a real turnaround case. Like, it was doing some stuff that I wasn't 100% buying into a while ago. And these days, in the last especially short while of films that have come out, so I guess that they've been in production for a while, but the last few crop of films out of Digital Domain have just been stellar work.
Yeah, I really felt like they were, you know, obviously really, really good at one point, and then it did seem like they were kind of faltering and not moving forward. And the current work has been really, really fantastic, you know, coming out of there. And you know, one of the things I always want to kind of point out is that, you know, I think that David Fincher is another one of those kind of next generation directors who understands the pipeline, you know, well enough to make those decisions on set in a way that, you know, a lot of folks that aren't as technically understanding how the entire process works, they don't know what's possible. They don't know what corners they could actually cut and get away with it. And his background, like Robert Rodriguez or like, George Lucas or, James Cameron, you know, these are people who understand this pipeline well enough to make those decisions, intelligently.
And I think the other thing that's really good about the people you just mentioned, and not obviously exclusively, but many of those films from those directors have been quite fantastical in the sense they're not photoreal. They're certainly not period dramas. This is a period drama that is, to all intents and purposes, just a real narrative flow.
Right.
And so, you know, it's all very well to sort of go, well, if I'm making Spy Kids 3, I'll do it all digitally because, you know, everything's going to be on green screen anyway. For this film, it was, you know, there was cinematography there that was just gorgeous cinematography, but it wasn't going for anything that was out of the ordinary. It was a desaturated, period-looking thing. And I always find that that's a better acid test for this technology and this workflow. If you can pull off a film like this without it looking, you know, because it's almost to a certain extent, we imagine that on a Star Wars Ep 3, they can do anything they want, right? I mean, A, it's ILM, and B, it's got a huge budget And, well, it's ILM.
Right, right. Yeah, and this is when people talk about, you know, the effects truly serving the story. I mean, this is a great example.
Totally.
You know that this is really, you know, it's really designed for you not to see them at all, and you still have, I mean, it's amazing how far we've come, and maybe I'm just getting too old, but I go, man, I can remember when 200 effect shots was a lot of effect shots for a film.
Yeah, you know, well, I was talking to a company about a story that's coming up on FX Guide, and it's a story on the film 23. And I was saying to them, so are there any sort of peculiar 23 number things, you know, because there's a lot of things about how various combinations of letters added up to 23, including cast members' names. And they were like, right. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the average age of the artist that worked on it was 23. And I was like, wow. Okay, then.
The average age? That's crazy.
Isn't it?
They had like a bunch of 16-year-olds in there.
Well, know, I think there was... they might have been pulling my leg, but I don't think it's far off the truth. I think that obviously if you've got a large film going on and you need to have a lot of people doing, well, for example, roto and stuff like that, then you know you obviously have senior experienced supervisors. And in this case, it was Intelligent Creatures, and they definitely do have very senior, very knowledgeable people. But yeah, them, you know, there is a large generation of very technically literate people in their 20s that are getting great positions on these films and doing great work. I have no idea what the average age of Digital Domain or Matwell Digital staff is, but
older.
I should have found that out, I guess. Hey, the other thing I was going to ask you about was, I thought this was kind of interesting. One of the things that happened when the Viper first came out, and certainly we're all aware of, is LUTs. And what I thought was interesting on this is that they got all set for this to be a big production with 9 different LUTs, and they got it set up so the DOP could create LUTs for the camera for different looks, for different scenes, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, as the film progressed, they got down to 1 LUT, which was their pretty much standard color correction, which they applied globally to everything before it went into to Final Cut, and they kind of left it at that. And it was an interesting discussion that... You know, that you can sometimes gear up the most interesting technical stuff, which, of course, you know, all works on paper and is actually quite good in a test lab environment. Of, like, wouldn't it be great if we could do this with the internet and then you could send this LUT and then I could check? And then when you hit the hard thrust of an actual production, you go, you know what? If you give me 1 LUT, I know where I am. I can judge off that. I know we can grade it later. We'll just move on.
We do in the smaller round, not the visual effects. You know, we do a lot of these little shoots for broadband shows you know, we'll talk, I always get this push and pull between cameramen and myself, you know, for this stuff because they're all white balancing and I'm like, okay, so we're going to turn all of the cameras to indoor automatic, you know, like not automatic, but like indoor, you know, just set them all to indoor because I want them all to be the same. You know, I don't want us to figure this out. You know, I can fix it later as long as they're not, you know, in many, many different places, you know, and in many ways, it's a similar situation where, you know, you just, it is, I always think of one of my favorite scenes from, I think it's from Black Hawk Down, you know, when they're getting ready to go into battle, and one of the Delta Force guys is sitting next to the Ranger, and the Ranger's got all this stuff, and he's trying to figure out what he needs, and the Special Forces guy's like, okay, you don't need that, you need this, you don't need that, you need this, you know, and but from someone who's been in fire, you know, there's a whole different reality to you know, what's necessary, and it's amazing how quickly a lot of the stuff that theoretically made sense falls away pretty quick.
Yeah, and I mean, to the credit of the guys that worked on it, they made the point that they actually thought that was a good thing, right? They thought it was good that they had it and that they were not using it rather than needing it and not having it, right? And they were totally up for it. They didn't mind at all. But it is pretty funny that you can sometimes, you know, with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of genuine energy, develop quite complex pipelines. And then at some point, it's like, as you say, like, you know, what I need to not die right now is this.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Now, on that note, I should perhaps beg off, and I think you have a huge amount of stuff on yourself, and between the two of us, we may need to wrap up to keep on our deadlines.
Yes, I think I'm back to a key, actually. I got a shake open here, so we're gonna jump off here, and thank you very much, Mike. Where can people find more about you?
At fxguide.com or fxphd.com.
And then, of course, you can find this show and many other shows at pixelcore.tv. We're putting up more and more shows over the next couple of weeks, so make sure to check it out.
And Alex, just before we go, I just want to thank our producers who have been doing a brilliant job on...
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, absolutely.
Just because you know what? I always joke producers never get thanked. They just get to go to producer heaven. But our guys have been brilliant, and I just want to single them out and say thanks, guys.
You know, we've lined up, you know, we have a lot of producers within Pixel Core working on all these shows. And when I started putting it together, I was like, I just didn't know if it was going to work. And you know, in general, it's just been such a fantastic group all the way across. And especially, I mean, this has been a really great, we feel very supported. And I feel very supported in a lot of our shows. And especially this one has been a really well-researched show. So definitely thank you to those producers. I will be back. What's next? Do we know what's next? Should we say what's next?
I don't think we should stick our neck out at this stage.
Oh, there I do want to say
one, no, actually, I have one other thing. Sorry to butt in a second time. But on the last show about 300, a point came up from John about how they were shooting. And I said I'd get back and research it, and I did. And we actually managed to get on to Chris Watts, the visual effects supervisor. And I don't know if you heard the show, but we were talking about the fact that on 300, there are a lot of shots where there doesn't seem to be a cut, but we're flying in and out of the footage as if we're doing these rapid zooms. And the way this was achieved, John alluded to, was there were three cameras. And he said, oh, you'd know all about that. And I was like, I have no idea, but I will find out. Anyway, that's exactly what they did. I thought it was a really interesting thing. And for those people that are interested, they literally had three cameras with three different lenses strapped together so that when in one scene with a lot of fighting going on, they could effectively morph between a wide shot, a close-up on a very precise piece of action, and out again. John was 100% right, and it was... I actually then got to see the film again in IMAX the other night, which was pretty incredible in of its own right.
Overwhelming.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I was watching, of course, and the first time I just bought it, you know, which is, I guess, is a good thing. I was just into the action and like, what, for God's sake, duck, don't get hit with that sword. And, of course, the second time through, I was able to sort of appreciate it. So he was absolutely right, and if he was here now, I'd tell him so.
And also, if people have comments or questions, definitely come up to pixelcore.tv. We have a comment and question area. You can come up here and make more comments about what we're talking about, and we'd love to hear from you all.
Yeah, if we skip over something, tell us and we'll research it for you and try and get back to you, because I think we'd like to be more interactive with the audience, wouldn't we, Alex?
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that we're going to start, we're playing around with some options of going live, so we'll see how that goes, let people call in. So that would be nifty.
But anyway, good talking to you again, and good meeting up in San Francisco when I was there, even though there were no serial killers.
Yeah, you know, we try to produce them when we can. And anyway, I'll see you soon, Mike.
Talk to you later.
For everyone listening, until next time, keep it real.